in every sleepless night. Bring me to where I am. Women that broke my heart, they became hoes that scam.
Show.
Oh my God. What is it?
Show me a better way.
Promise I'll quit this game. This much I know it's true. Pat and John came up and...
Oh boy. Came up and so...
And so, so could you. So fuck them boys in blue.
Can I just say, I like that you did a nice little Walmart-esque edit of the line, bitches that broke my heart.
Well, okay, but John, did, you could have said that.
But didn't
for
do one.
It now. Yeah.
Didn't do one for they became hoes that scam.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I feel like that's like that type of like half, you know, awareness, half inclusivity is like pretty indicative of just like our show in general. So,
well,
brand is strong.
We're trying.
But yeah, we're trying, and that's what matters. That's the Pat and John guarantee.
First of all, hilarious. It's the number one song played on my iPod, and yet I totally forgot all of the words. Also, I've been out and about in the world. And this was like the first song that I listened to. Okay, sorry. Welcome to another episode of Pat and John and Their Best Behavior.
The last episode of Pat and John on Their Best Behavior, it sounds like. I'm John.
Hi. Welcome to our show. The anecdote that I was trying to explain, but I forgot about how our show works for the past 48 episodes. Rascal by Rumor was kind of like the last song that like pumped me up before the Pandy Wandy.
Right.
And now that I've been vaxxed and out and about and hugging people, it feels like it's over. So I thought I just wanted to bring the song back for posterity's sake.
Sure. I mean, the time is always right. The time is truly always right.
How's the show going so far? How's this episode going?
Yeah,
so
leave us a rating and a review. Maybe do two: one for how this episode is going, and then maybe one to balance things out about how much you've been enjoying the podcast writ large.
Yeah,
and while we're at it, go ahead and like us on Instagram. You'll definitely want to do it for this episode because we're hopefully going to be posting a clip. As we've done, so you'll have a visual component to this episode, which is good because I recently bought a new hat. I replaced my old one, which I've had for like 3 years and is very very tattered and very battered.
You look like you had it for 70.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I have a weird shaped head. Like you don't notice it when my head isn't shaved, but I have a weird shaped head, and a lot of hats are very flattering on me, so it's really hard to find one that I like. And bear in mind, this was just like, this is one that I stole from my mom, and like I'm pretty sure she bought it like at like, I don't even, like, it looks like it's like a gas station like type of hat, like you just find it on like a rack or like a Rite Aid or something like that. And I just like started wearing it because I got a really shitty haircut one time, and then I just stole it from her, and that's like the hat that I've been wearing for years and years now. And I reached out to the company. Here, let me see if I can find the name of the company.
Please don't give them airtime if they're not going to sponsor us.
Well, I won't. It's called Royal Resort Wear. I emailed them and I asked them about this hat because I was like, I literally like this hat. I can't find it on your website, but I really like this hat. So if I can possibly, like, I will pay extra to have it custom made, but they don't have that hat in stock anymore. So I had to buy a run of the mill type of, they're called like dad caps, like on Amazon. And I'm debuting it right now. I'm not crazy about it. The brim doesn't really work to the extent that the other one did, but like a new haircut, I'm hoping that I'll get used to it.
when you emailed them, that was the first email they had actually ever received. This company had ever received. They were
absolutely.
Is there a template we follow? Somebody actually emailed us.
Yeah, I was corresponding with someone named Susan, which of course her name is Susan. Of course, this, the name of this poor woman is Susan. And she had to deal with some very detailed emails from me. So truly, like all of our guests that we've booked,
sorry in advance.
Yeah thanks to Susan.
Well, I'm turning 29 this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured what better way to celebrate Allergy Awareness Month.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Teacher Appreciation Week.
Yes, which Pat learns, much to his chagrin, is not just a single day, but it's an entire week of nonsense.
I mean, if there was a month, I would rip up every diploma I had. Then to have a bit of a Pat and John play catch-up, except it's John plays catch-up.
Yeah, we thought that the Pat and John play catch up that we did in honor of my birthday, where Pat caught up on three things that I rec— Oh wait, we didn't do that. That wasn't
but
a thing that we did.
What he doesn't know is that I proposed this episode, which was a bit egotistical,
mm-hmm.
which he knows comes with the territory.
Right.
But I watched a movie that he has watched, and we didn't really talk about it last week. Or I'm sorry, yes, last week with our Oscars, 2 weeks ago with our Oscars preview with Brendan Bendorf.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured, John, I'll throw you a couple bones
okay.
on this episode of Pat and John. I watched Tenet over the weekend.
Oh, that's not what I was thinking of. I was thinking of something else that you just watched.
What were you
also
thinking about?
I was thinking of In the Mood for Love.
When are we could talk about that one too.
Yeah, let's talk about an actual good movie.
Let's talk about those really quickly before we go into our real episode. So I watched Tenet.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, I really tried.
Yeah.
I really, really, really tried. If anyone is going to try for a movie like Tenet, it's this guy.
Yeah, you and only you.
I really didn't like it. I really didn't like it.
Because you texted me. I was at a party. This was the party that I woke up the following day very, very hungover from. And he texted me, and I forget exactly what you said, but you're like, just, I'm starting to watch Tenet. This movie rules.
It fucking rules.
And I almost just went off on Pat for that clunker of a take. But it sounds like that take didn't really hold up for the rest of the movie's 7-hour runtime.
It ruled until after they blew up the thing in Norway with the plane.
Ah, okay.
Then I was like, oh, Nolan kind of played his hand, and John David Washington doesn't actually have a character.
Right.
And his character only speaks in exposition.
Yes.
And in fact, all the characters only speak in exposition.
None of which helps.
None of which helps. And, yeah, I just was really disappointed. I was really disappointed. If I saw this in a theater, which I told Brendan I was really jealous that he saw it in the theater, but I was going, I would have gone nuts without subtitles. I would have gone nutsy, nutsy, nutsy without subtitles.
Yeah. I mean, it's just not a good movie. Like, there's just that's like, you could say a lot more about it, but you don't really need to. Yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's incomprehensible, which can be fine sometimes,
sure.
But like, it just really crosses the threshold into incomprehensiveness without any real upside in the way that some of Nolan's other films do. And even then, those aren't my favorite. I don't like Inception. I didn't like it when I saw it. I still don't. My favorite Christopher Nolan film is Dunkirk. I think Pat's checking his watch, his very nice watch.
That doesn't work. That I totally played my hand in that too,
right?
Like Christopher Nolan.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just didn't have a good time with it. I thought that maybe some of that had to do with the fact that I watched it on a laptop. Mm-hmm. Like, in, I watched a rip of it, like a 720 rip of it on my laptop.
Okay, well, let's don't indict yourself. But yeah, you watched it on a laptop. Yeah.
I'm willing to bet that Pat did not do that. He probably saw it in a slightly higher scale of viewing experience.
No, I did it on, I watched it on HBO Max.
Well, you didn't pay for it, at least.
No, I didn't. I just was like... Yeah, I loved Robert I love whatever Robert Pattinson was doing, but he was in a different movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a different movie, and I don't know. I just was, yeah, it's tough. It's tough because Nolan was like, this is going to save movie theaters, and
it didn't. It didn't. Godzilla versus Kong and Mortal Kombat did instead.
Yes,
the joke is
yes.
on
and
all of us.
And some anime that I've never heard of is like the most popular movie ever. Do you know this about this movie anime called Demon Slayer?
No.
Every showing in New York is sold. Well, we're not anime people, so it...
We're not.
All right, so that's as far as this conversation goes. And yes, I did watch In the Mood for Love last night.
Was it inspired by the fact that I recently watched it?
Because you had watched it because...
And Pat can't let me see a foreign film, a movie that involves subtitles, and him not having watched it. So
does,
he cannot be outdone.
Does Tenet count as a foreign film with the subtitles?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I could have watched In the Mood for Love without subtitles and have had much more of a sense of what was going on.
Sure.
Than I did.
And a better time too.
A much better time.
You'd
yeah.
be like,
and it's only
wow.
an hour and a half too.
There's real people.
Yeah.
I watched In the Mood for Love last night. I was just so blown away. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of more fun to talk about Tenet cause you can just shit on it and be like, nothing
right.
makes sense.
Right.
But yeah, In the Mood, I was thinking about, I've been, the ending of In the Mood for Love is like, stuck in my head, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he walks through the city and you think like... Cities like that, that are that well preserved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Angkor Wat. It's like you walk through a place like that and it's very eerie because you can feel the ghosts and spirit. What am I doing? I believe this, though. You believe? Like,
I don't doubt it.
The ghosts and spirits have lived there, and it's like, how many heartbreaks have taken place there?
Sure.
How many unrequited loves have taken place there? And like,
I mean, just a few less than the campus of Skidmore College.
You know what the one good thing about heartbreak is, John?
What?
That you're not alone.
Mm.
You are part of a lineage of people who've gotten their heart broken.
Yeah. Yeah. You're part of a very unfortunate collective. Yeah. Much like the listeners of this podcast. Is this your first, how do you pronounce this? Is his last
Wong
Kar
Wai.
It's
Wai.
Okay. I was thinking
it
was Y or Way. Is this your first movie of his that you've seen?
The second. I've seen Chungking Express.
Okay. I need to watch that next.
Yeah.
Did you, is better? Which do you prefer?
They're different. They're so different.
Okay.
This Chungking Express is, it's handheld. It's very like, it's kind of like the a Breathless-esque.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, it's very like wily and funky characters. And...
The fifth movie that we've referenced that none of our listeners have watched, just after recording for like 10 minutes. Yeah. And for those of you who are not familiar with the work of War Kong Wai, he is essentially, as we talked about on our episode with Spencer Ryder, in which we talked about film discourse and what a dumpster fire it is, he is like the most influential filmmaker for Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk, and the upcoming miniseries, The Underground Railroad. So if for no other reason,
I only know him from the Lion King sequel, but right. I guess I'll check out his other work too.
Yeah, featuring some really incredible close-ups of Simba and Nala looking at one another. You can really see the details, the sun glistening on their whiskers and their fur and their manes. But it's great. I mean, it's great that you watch In the Mood for Love to kind of, you know, so now you're at like net zero in terms of like your cinematic experience of
culture. It's a very erotic movie too.
Yeah. And without any actual nudity or sex.
Yes.
It's PG. Yes. When was the last time you watched a PG-rated movie and enjoyed it? Besides Newsies, of course.
I guess Paddington and In the Mood for Love. So yeah.
Oh, Paddington's, but that's G. So I mean, don't you can't.
Oh, like, really?
Yeah, don't shortchange Paddington. Yeah, yeah.
Paddington, who has dethroned Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
As the greatest movie of all time.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, arguably, I wouldn't say rightfully so, but there's an argument to be made. Wait, I want to fact check myself to make sure that it is actually in fact rated G. I don't want
to. It's gotta be PG. I think there's like a few swear words.
It is rated PG for some action and mild rude humor. Which like explains why Pat had such a hard time with it for some of it. Yes, like this podcast, exactly. All right. Well, do we want to just settle right in as if we haven't spent 15 minutes just dicking around.
You're so scared about how I started this podcast that we would ever get to what we're talking about. Yeah. Guys, that's what we call a John LeMay dad moment. That was with the dad cap.
Yeah. 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 That's me stopping, or that's me, the wife of this podcast, nudging Pat as he's driving to stop to ask for directions.
With my Coke bottle glasses, because I can't see the road.
Right.
I asked John to watch two movies,
mm-hmm.
listen to one album.
It's a mixtape.
I'm sorry. Well, to me, it's an album because I elevate it.
Sure, right.
I elevate it to an album.
Right.
The first movie we're going to talk about is a movie called The Long Goodbye, directed by Robert Altman. I picked this for you, John, because it's a noir.
Mm-hmm.
One of your favorite genres. Might be your favorite genre.
It's up there. Probably the genre that I know, like, the most about. Like, even if it's not my favorite, it's the one I know the most about and can, you know, unfortunately for anyone who asks, can pontificate about and theorize about.
What he said. It's a noir. There's a writer character.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who, spoilers, kills themselves.
Mm-hmm. And is based off a subject of a much heralded documentary, Mr. Ernest Hemingway.
And why else did I pick this movie? There is a lot of Safdie brother energy in this movie.
Oh yeah,
which we can talk about. But John, what did you think about? Oh God. Okay. I will do this.
Yeah, perfect.
The Long Goodbye is about a private detective named Robert Marlowe, played by the great
Philip Marlowe.
Oh boy,
sorry,
Philip Marlowe.
He's the most famous like private eye in the history of noir. So this is just one of those things we need to get. We need to get right.
Right. What John said. He's a private. I called him detective. He's a private eye. Mm-hmm. Written by Raymond Carver.
Raymond Chandler. But Raymond Carver is. He's also a writer. But Raymond Chandler,
guys,
potentially the most famous author of hardboiled detective fiction, next to Dashiell Hammett.
Elliot Gould plays Philip Marlowe, mm-hmm. and he investigates the murder and disappearance of a close compatriot of his.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of falls into this web of... you know, this tangled web of an affair and money and
like most noirs and American hardboiled detective novels or stories, like it starts off with a simple like task, a simple thing he has to investigate.
Yes.
And then as he delves into it, the web becomes incredibly tangled to the point that the viewer has no idea what's going on.
Sure.
And the detective has no idea what's going on. I should say also that Philip Marlowe is the main character of one of the most famous film noirs of all time, The Big Sleep, which was released in the 1940s and stars Humphrey Bogart and is kind of like one of the most prototypical film noirs. I mean, and this is technically a neo-noir, which is like an important distinction because it has like so many different, it does so many different things than like a your typical, you know, 40s, 50s noir with its black and white and its Venetian blinds and its like saxophone and, you know, weird ways of speaking and all that kind of stuff. So
well, the camera in The Long Goodbye is one of my favorite things.
It's so good.
Because it is so acrobatic. And there's a lot of scenes where, like, Marlowe is in his apartment and the camera just swings around to everybody talking. And you see there's he lives next to these like these this naked coven of women.
Right, right.
And the camera
which
focused...
when Pat saw that, he was like, oh, I chose the wrong apartment, didn't I? Which is fair. I did too, apparently.
I started throwing rocks at all of my neighbors' windows to see what would happen. It's just a masterful movie. It's so tight. Going back to what I said about the Safdie brothers thing, there's a lot of overlapping dialogue. You have to really concentrate on picking out what certain characters are saying.
Yeah.
People interrupt each other all the time. Of course, Robert Altman was famous for this like naturalistic improvisational dialogue. And I just, you know, some of the shots in this film, especially using windows, I'm thinking of the shot when the writer Roger Waite kills himself, when you're watching Marlowe and Roger's wife speak, and then in the window you see Roger walking into the ocean.
Yes.
I mean, it's just...
It's incredible.
I mean, it's fucking incredible. Now, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
When he goes to get his cat food at the grocery store, which is an amazing sequence. It's
incredible
like,
scene.
It's like, you'd think it'd be a throwaway scene, but it's like, it's so beautiful. What famous noir took its inspiration from that, basically stole a scene, stole its opening from that scene?
Famous noir took, so more modern noir took it a from more, The Long Goodbye. More,
More modern noir.
Oh God, I don't know. Can I get a hint?
Think about a noir that starts at a grocery store, and he pays for the cream with a check.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Directed by brothers.
Well, I was thinking
The Big Lebowski.
Oh, it's been so long since I've seen that movie. I wasn't even thinking about it. I'll take your word for that because I honestly don't remember it. And I also saw that movie before. I didn't see it after I became obsessed with noir, but it was before I like really expanded my understanding of like what noir is.
Okay.
So kind of thought about like neo-noirs and thought of like The Big Lebowski as like the possibility of being a noir, even though it doesn't have like all of the trappings of the genre.
Okay. When at the beginning of The Big Lebowski, he goes to a really artificially lit grocery store and kind of like walks around and is like just looking for cream for his white Russians.
Okay.
And in this movie, he wanders around the artificially lit grocery store looking for cat food.
Okay.
So,
gotcha.
So, yeah.
So, okay. So you've touched on a lot of stuff that I also took notes on. So let me try to tap into that. So, yes, I also, one of my favorite things about this was the fact that the camera is always moving or sort of roving. And one of the scenes I thought about was that zoom in on Roger walking into Roger, the author who kills himself, walking into the ocean. And the fact that it also does it while the levels of the sound like don't change at all. Like you still hear the conversation that's happening like immediately in the scene, but what's happening, like it's not as if like as it zooms in, like the sound of the waves becomes louder or something along those lines. It just kind of retains all elements of it. And there's like, it seems like it's kind of like to some degree kind of going back to what we said about Citizen Kane, like kind of like an homage to like the idea of like deep focus, but it's like a different kind of deep focus. Right, it's like you're aware of what's happening in the background and then you become more aware of what's happening in the background as well. I'm sure there's like an actual cinematography terminology, like piece of terminology about that kind of stuff, but that's what I thought of while it was happening.
Sure. That sequence is incredible because they also, the dog, when yes. Roger actually dies, the dog that has been this like motif of like keeping Detective Marlowe out of the house, because it's kind of like, you know, he really knows that he's going to find the truth about Roger and like yeah. that family. The barking of the dog gets louder and louder as Roger dies too. And it's like, it's kind of right. dizzying.
Yeah.
It's like such a beautiful way to like, because you don't actually see him drown.
Right.
You just like, he just goes off.
But the dog does go into the water and he does mm-hmm. fetch the cane.
The cane.
And he carries that.
Haunting.
Over. Yeah. Truly haunting. Haunting. Another really incredible scene featuring Roger is when Roger, and I don't know his name, but the person who like was keeping him at like the
Verringer, Dr. Verringer.
Okay, Dr. Verringer. It's when they're talking and like Marlowe is watching it through the window and the camera, mm-hmm. it just moves back and forth between the two of them, but not even in like a particularly
yeah, it's like racking focus. It's called yeah. racking focus when you highlight something in the background and then the foreground, and then right. you switch back and forth between them.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not even as if like when Roger is saying something, it very quickly finds its way, the camera finds its way over to him, and then when the other guy is talking, it finds it's just like it's very like it will the camera will start moving over to Dr. Verringer like mm. as he's beginning to talk, but it won't actually find its way over to him until he's finished his sentence. And that yeah. to me, it kind of serves like to kind of imbue the scene with that more naturalistic like style of filmmaking, but also to serve as a way to kind of like contrast between like film noir and like neo-noir. Like if that were if this were a film noir scene, like it would be very quick cuts. Like Roger would say something, quick cut to Verringer as he's saying something, and just going back and forth, and maybe like would have a cut back to like Marlowe as he's listening, because that's like part of what film noir is. It's just like it's there's like a frenetic energy to it, and it's just like the scenes are just very quickly paced, but this is doing something very, very different, which I think is really incredible. On the subject of contrast with film noir, I thought there were a lot of really interesting like meta-textual aspects to this movie, like
sure.
ways in which it is very clearly commenting on the genre of film noir and sort of like making it aware, it's making the audience aware of the fact that it like is also aware of the conventions. And the scene with the clerk in the grocery store made me think of that. There's a scene where Philip Marlowe is like asking the clerk about like something about cat food. Mm. And the clerk actually walks over to him and asks Marlowe to speak more clearly. Like he's saying that he's mumbling too much. Mm. And I feel like that's very obviously like a comment on like that typical like hard-boiled detective way of speaking, which is very fast, very like muttery. And just the fact that he like, hey man, like I can't hear you, like can you speak up more clearly, like that felt like it was something doing something very something very self-aware about like commenting on those aspects of the film noir genre and sort of like satirizing it. There's also a scene,
well I mean just the fact that the movie is shot in daylight,
yeah. Yes.
Especially like the Malibu sun, like there, especially I'm thinking about the party. I'm thinking about the great conversation where Roger Wade is like, I made a career. You don't get to where I am if you don't know what a good face is. You know
right,
what I mean? Like,
right, right.
And I do feel like Roger is a commentary on like Humphrey Bogart, old masculinity.
Totally.
Especially Hemingway.
Yeah.
Like Roger yeah. is a vessel for that kind of masculinity. And Philip Marlowe, you know, played by Elliot Gould, is like the kind of new 70s, like not sensitive. I do want to say sensitive because he does have like, he is sensitive and he's like not a great detective. Like,
right.
Like he's getting the shit kicked out of him and he's like kind of just stumbling into these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's an element of that in the classic film noir, but it's also like heightened in some ways. And it's actually made clear with another scene in the clerk or the grocery store scene where Marlo asks the clerk if he has a cat, and the clerk says something along the lines of, I don't need a cat, I have a girl.
Yes.
And even that, like, that is making it very clear. Like, it's kind of like, if you haven't gotten it already, it's like, Marlo is lonely. He only has a cat. He's like, it's outlining, like, or highlighting his isolation, which again is like implied in most classic noir, but it's like making it very clear. That's like, this is the convention that we're working with. Like, he's an outsider. He's watching other people live their lives. He's watching all the naked women in there, you know,
across the street, but
doesn't have any, yeah, no naked woman of his own.
Everyone around him, his life is getting destroyed by their sort of sexual pursuits.
Yeah.
And he is totally, like, he doesn't have a sex life at all.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't have a sex life at all.
Which is so interesting, because it's like, that is implied in other movies, or in previous Philip Marlowe movies, like in The Big Sleep, it's implied that, like, he has sex, but it has to be done within, like, the confines of the Hays Code, like the very strict rules that the Catholic Church put on, like, what could or couldn't be shown in movies.
Sure. Like the rules put on my Instagram story.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. By your parents. Yeah. But it's, they don't capitalize on that. Like, yes, there is nudity, but it's just like the naked women across the street. And it's kind of like, to some degree, it's there because they can have it, and they can show, like, that this is a movie that's in the 70s, not in the 40s, and we can have naked women. But it's not as if there's like a super gratuitous sex scene between Marlo and someone else.
Well, in the way he doesn't even confront their nudity. Like, how he just goes over there and he's always like, okay, girls, yeah, I'll get your brownie mix.
Right.
Like, and he's dressed like a square, and they represent this, like, new, like, California, like, hippie sexuality. It's, there's...
Kind of reinforcing that he's, like, a man out of time.
Okay,
and then last thing about the metatextual aspects.
Please,
because there's so much I could say about this. There's also the security guard who does impressions of famous celebrities.
Yes.
And like every single time Marlo encounters him, he's always like, hey, guess who this is? And then he'll do like a really terrible impression of some sort of celebrity. And every single celebrity that he does an impression of is either a notable or a less than notable, but is still a celebrity from a classic film noir. So he does an impression of Barbara Stanwyck, who is the femme fatale from Double Indemnity, arguably one of the most famous film noirs of all time. He does an impression of Jimmy Stewart, who is from Vertigo, another very, very famous film noir. He does an impression of Cary Grant, who is featured in Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious. And then he does an impression of Walter Brennan, who is featured in the film noir Nobody Lives Forever. So all of those, and I don't know if those are in the book Farewell My Lovely by Raymond Chandler, but I just thought it was just funny that they kind of like sprinkled those Easter eggs in there, kind of like, because again, the way that he's highlighting like how absurd these characters talk and how absurd they sound, which is a thing that was kind of like normalized in these movies, because that's just like what acting was back then. Like, if you were an actor, you talked with a funny voice. Like, why would you talk like you actually talk? So it's just like, once again, like playing, like poking fun at that very artificial, theatrical, stylized way of filmmaking, and in a more naturalistic way of filmmaking that was so prevalent in the 1970s.
Right, because this is post Brando, post like Actors Playhouse,
right,
where like, you know, everyone is like, you know, method the fuck out,
right. And Robert Altman is obviously like, you know, he's a huge like icon of that entire way of filmmaking. Yeah,
I did good with this one.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I would say that like I prefer my Philip Marlowe in The Big Sleep, played by Humphrey Bogart, and I would say like that's probably like that it just tends to be like my preferred like type of noir in general. But no, this was great. It's like it's super. You can tell that it's very innovative. You can understand like why this is kind of like a controversial film noir in the way that it is. Like, a lot of people like had very strong opinions about Philip Marlowe being played in this particular way, or like a Raymond Chandler like novel being, you know, at the time contemporized. But I think it works really well, and I think it I think it's just a great movie that I'm glad that I added to my list of neo-noirs.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Speaking of innovative.
Oh, here he goes. Here he goes.
Speaking of groundbreaking, speaking of a fusion between the old and the new, I think
that's what's going on. No, go. Here. Keep going.
That's really all that I have. So how about you tell us what the second piece of media that I was assigned that we're going to be talking about is?
Rich Gang, The Tour, Part 1.
Part 1. Part the first. Oh,
and there was never a part 2.
Mm.
So, a couple weeks ago, we did our John Loves Emo episode. And John, you spoke about all these groups. They'd get together and then,
release an EP and then don't do anything again.
Alas. Well, here is the Atlanta version, post-Gucci, post-Lil Wayne. This is the Atlanta version of said New England emo band. So at this point in time, you have Young Thug, who has released a couple singles and is gaining popularity, and you also have Rich Homie Quan, who's the same kind of in the same vein, but Rich Homie Quan's much more... I don't want to say he's like Young Thug with the edges sanded off, but he's much more a realist, and he sticks to the sing song.
I'll say this later on, but he's kind of like your old fashioned like spitter with like a little bit of like melody thrown in there.
Like, there's no Lil Baby without Rich Homie Quan.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you've listened to a Lil Baby song and you listen to Rich Homie Quan, like Rich Homie Quan is like his uncle, like. The same kind of flows, same kind of everything. And Young Thug is like, especially this part of his career, he is experimenting, squawking, squeaking, growling, you know, all sorts of onomatopoeias, inserting all sorts of onomatopoeias into his music.
Good literary term.
Thank you so much. hey, you can follow me at patpoetry.com. And they were brought together by a gentleman named Birdman, who at the time was Splitsville with his former muse, Lil Wayne. Young Thug is a self-professed Lil Wayne super fan. And Birdman, I think, was just looking for the next generation of, well, really a rapper that would rappers that would stay up all night and record music at a frantic pace to release.
Right.
So... they released a song called Lifestyle. Do you remember? Did you listen to Lifestyle when it came out?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Like, pre-streaming, massive hit, weird. No one actually knew what Young Thug said during the chorus. And these two recorded an album. And it is widely cited as one of the most important pre-streaming mixtapes of the 2010s.
How did they release it? Was it not, was Dat Piff? Was Dat that Piff. Was it? Okay.
Yep. Dat Piff. So you have the wild, eccentric, experimental stylings of Young Thug over here, and you have the sort of more grounded, natural, bluesy stylings of Rich Homie Quan over here. And I think the best thing to do is just listen to John, let's listen to your song, because I picked two solos. So they have, so in the album, Young Thug has some songs, solo songs, and then Rich Homie Quan has some solo songs, but you picked one that has both of them. So let's listen to that one first.
And there's a reason, because those are the ones that I enjoyed the most.
The duos.
Great. Okay. So I chose, it's one of the earlier, I think it's like the sixth or seventh song on the mixtape. And this one is called Flava. And as ever, we'll listen to the first minute or so of the song.
The remedy. We got London on the track. Couple rollin', yes, I rollin', and I pull up on that little nigga, but bless a nigga, know that he. Where your heart at? I won't pull it up like my wedding. She know that she the bomb, nigga, load his head. Yeah, nigga. And they bitchin', know they fuckin', and they suckin' when they get inside that bed with me and me, yo. Hey. And she fuckin' if I say so, plus she suckin' if I say so, and she love it if I say so. And we fuckin', we gon' pay em. What? How the fuck I'm gon' buy a phone bill?
Rich, yeah. I'ma come a week later. We'll listen to a little more than a minute, because I want to hear both of them. Both of them on the track. She on the cover, fade em. And she say it's my time, like, play em. Plus, I ain't no way fishing, but I bait em. She better have a motherfucker close up. Wanna meet three of them, and you know that I'm pimp, drip, booted up. I ain't about to doze off. Nah. Little nigga, you a shrunk, walking with a limp. I ain't had sell, word the beat, took clothes off. Lord shit that made me sleepy, Lord Zan, Lord Perk shit. All these drugs got me throwed off. I love my bitch, I can't go without. Wanna give him a seat, no, sunflower. I got strong jeans, my little boy legit like. Ain't trying to be what you want no one night. So I'm talking about what's done, put up with that nigga, bitch. Okay. I think you get the idea.
I don't. I need more ideas. But yes, yes.
Yeah, I forgot. Oh, this is my favorite one, but I should have picked one that has the two of them closer to one another. I totally spaced on the Birdman bit, which I also enjoyed. I also enjoyed the Birdman bit.
Oh boy, yeah. John, what did you think about this album? I've talked too much. Talk to me.
I mean, yeah, I really loved it. I love like the two of them combined. I mean, I am not a huge Rachomi Kwan fan. Like, you know, like a lot of people who are still really influential rappers or really great rappers, like the projects that have like a sense of cohesion and consistency to them, just like. If they're there, I have not stumbled upon them and haven't, like, that hasn't been presented to me. I mean, sure. I still, like, obviously respect him and just love the fact that he has, like, that kind of, like, crooning aspect to him, but also, like, can just, like, just as his lyrics are just really fun and, like, punchline based in the way that, like, just does kind of herald back or harken back to, like, an earlier era, which Young Thug is as well, but it's just that kind of gets lost in just the wild experimentation of his music. Yes. But I love, it's like, it's such an easy, happy, obvious marriage that works so well. And hearing them go back and forth, is just fun. It's just super fun. Like you can never really tell. Like people say like, they must've had such a fun time making this album. Like maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know, but it sounds like they're having fun.
Yeah.
I love the tracks. My favorite tracks are the ones where they're both on it and they're just both like, there's that sense of back and forth. And they just kind of like bring out the best in one another, because what the other has, like the other also has, but also like builds on and adds something new to it or adds something else to it that just makes for like such a like comprehensive experience that if you are like a fan of like contemporary modern rap, even though this isn't modern anymore because it moves so quickly.
Yeah.
It's just all there. And there's just like so many, there's so much like red meat for you to sink your teeth into.
But the melody of this album, especially if you listen to anything on Rap Caviar today, I mean, where all rappers are using melody for the most part, it's like, it's all here. It's all in this album. I mean, listen, when I listened to it the first time, what was it, 2014, so damn near 10 years ago, I was like, this is Lennon and McCartney. I mean, this is totemic.
Yeah.
This is absolutely totemic. And I was thinking a lot about, you know, Baby and Gunna, Lil Baby and Gunna had a collab album a couple years ago. And there is nothing that's a tenth as interesting as this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they literally Gunna taught Lil Baby how to rap.
Right.
Lil Baby was just in the studio and Gunna was like, I'm gonna write stuff for you to make. Like, you'd think that kind of connection.
Yeah. And the album is like, also like, feels like it's twice as long as this, even though this is not a short mixtape.
No. That tape, Drip Harder or whatever, that's like 39 minutes and it feels like 87 minutes.
Yeah.
And Rich Gang, the tour part one is 177 minutes.
Right.
And I was also thinking, because, you know, Young Thug, he released this new compilation album with everyone on his label. There's 37 songs on it. I've listened to all of them. And I was like, God, this guy, he really could use some structure. Like all great artists.
Sure.
John LeMay, Patrick Stanny, Young Thug. We could all use a little bit more.
Yeah, tightening up.
Tightening up.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and this mixtape feels very well curated, too.
Yes.
And that's part of why it works so well, in the way that I'd imagine, like, the Rich Gang, you know, collection probably doesn't. I didn't feel any need to necessarily go through and listen to all of that, even though I feel like I got a little bit of taste. But also, like, I don't know to what extent I really find all the other artists as interesting as the two artists, or even if they're interesting, I don't know if I necessarily like need to go hunting for the hidden gems. Like in a mixtape or a compilation of that nature. I just thought it was really fun. Oh yeah, go ahead.
Let's play a Thug song.
Yeah.
This is one of the most famous Young Thug songs of all time. I will play the Birdman bit because it's important. this is Givenchy by Young Thug. It's the first song on the album.
That Rich Gang lifestyle. Yes. Lifestyle. Marble floors, gold turtles, and chandeliers. Big money, nigga. Take the jet. L.A. hit the bitty, booling in a bondo with a few bitches, you know? And they go to trip.
And they go to trip.
Drinking that GTV, that tequila, smoking them stunner blunts.
The big dog,
nigga, we never hung over.
Never, boy.
Popping bigger numbers with my nigga. Straight B's on.
Straight B's.
Shout out to my love, my blood, my team, my gang, my family. Nigga, you know what we bleed.
The music video features some incredible shots of all parties involved drinking wine and smoking cigars, which Pat and I could never.
Yes, and the cigars have 100% tobacco in
them. Yes.
Bankroll mafia. How Beezer was bracken, nigga. The pussy out of line, the pussy get their head
bust.
You dig? B Logan Bentley. Y'all know the business. It's B Slime or G5. Bleh! Rest in peace, Tamara and Miss Gladys, boy.
That's Young Thug with
the crooning.
The yodel.
Rich Gang. Rich Gang.
Javinci, my toes and my bros and my hoes. Javinci, my toes and my bros and my hoes. For show, for show.
Javinci,
my toes and my bros and my hoes. For show, for show. Javinci, my toes and my bros and my hoes. And that is for sure, is for sure.
For show.
Tell them nigga, would you ride for a nigga, baby? Would you die for a nigga?
Oh, boy. Baby, memory lane for me.
Yeah.
For your nigga, baby?
Do you remember where you were when you first heard it?
Oh, I'm sure I was in Northwoods, in my Northwoods apartment. Just with, you know, a fucking hole out of my brain. You know?
Boy,
yeah.
They broke up shortly after. There's a video online at a Rich Homie Quan concert. Someone yells out about Young Thug, and Rich Homie Quan says, "I'm not with that gay shit." So,
wow,
Young Thug.
Was this after the 2000 after
the album?
And this was this after Dressgate?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Young Thug has worn a dress. He was calling his friends lovers at this time. It was really wild.
Yeah.
Like in a fun way. Like
yeah.
He was making wild music. He was saying this wild stuff. He was wearing dresses. It has long been speculated that what happened at that concert was just a small percent. Like, that was not indicative of – it's not that Rich Homie Quan was homophobic. Well, I mean, if you say something like that, I can't
defend
you. But
not inordinately so.
But we will probably never know what happened. Long story short, we will never know what happened.
So until Rich Homie Quan comes on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. And
I mean,
who else
would he want to talk to than the two of us?
And I mean, he literally has nothing to lose. So
yeah, true.
yeah, it's just interesting. Like Young Thug became like the most popular. He toned down the craziness a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, musically too. I don't just mean like the dress wearing.
Yeah.
And Rich Homie Quan kind of like. I still think he makes really consistent music still. I really like his mixtapes. I think they're really consistent, but it's just like, you know,
I mean, he doesn't have nearly the cultural footprint,
the streaming power or the cultural, you know, sort of clout as Thug. But speaking of you know, you're so good at this, and I started and I just halfway through it I was like, oh god, I can't do it. Speaking of great collaborations.
Sure.
Great collaborations. Yin and Yang.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the last movie I made you watch.
Oh, we're not going to listen to the other track?
No, I wanted to keep this one under an hour.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine.
We'll play it at the end.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, because I just want to say another song that I really like from this mixtape is Milk Marie. It's one of Rachomi Kwan's solo songs, also produced by Wheezy, which is part of why I think I like it so much. It has that like expansiveness and those killer snares that we love Wheezy for. Also just a really great song that I wasn't expecting to like as much as I did. So I just want to get that in under the wire before we moved on. But yes. I cut you off, but that segue was chef's kiss. So continue as you were.
Our next dynamic duo, Quentin Tarantino, Tony Scott.
Mm.
John, you're confronted with Tony Scott again on this podcast.
He is truly inescapable.
The last Pat and John play catch up, you watched Unstoppable. You were a fan.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it.
You were a fan. So now, taking you back a little further in time,
mm-hmm.
True Romance.
Yes.
Written by Quentin Tarantino. Starring?
Even before he wrote his first feature film, Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
So starring early Quentin.
The person that people consider my dad, my father. Yeah.
Chad Patrick Stanny, Christian Slater.
What did you think, John? Oh, fuck. Okay. True Romance is about...
Look, I didn't have to say it. And that means that you're learning, and that's all that we really can hope for.
True Romance follows a comic book shop. The guy who works at a comic book shop loves kung fu movies.
Mm-hmm.
This is written by Quentin Tarantino.
if you can imagine.
Gets the hottest gal in Detroit. He meets the hottest gal in Detroit. And she is... she's whoring for Gary Oldman.
Incredible.
Years before James Franco in Spring Breakers.
Right.
There was Gary Oldman's Drexel in True Romance.
Mm-hmm.
Christian Slater says, "You're my wife now. Gary Oldman's got to go." Kills Gary Oldman. They come across some cocaine. And they drive across country to sell cocaine and sell the cocaine and, you know, go out on the lam. And it ends. Yeah, that's all I'll say.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say. I spoiled one movie today. I'm going to leave the other one up for the audience to see.
It truly has to be watched in order to be believed.
The cast of this movie is insane.
Yeah.
A prepubescent Brad Pitt. He's not prepubescent, but he's really young.
Yeah.
Michael Rapaport, James Gandolfini.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel L. Jackson has a cameo in this movie.
Very brief cameo.
I mean, Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious.
Yes.
Can't do that scene in 2020.
Yeah, definitely not.
And
his imaginary Elvis friend.
What did you think, John?
So I...
The pause before John talks about a Tony Scott movie is like...
is one like... of the most agonizing experiences for Patrick Cressipstani. If I got my beak wet with Tony Scott and felt like I was enjoying some really a White Claw with a little bit of zest and a little bit of alcohol and I enjoyed, but maybe still left me wanting a little bit more, than True Romance is this Samuel Adams Summer Ale that I'm currently drinking, which has an even more enjoyable level of flavor to it, and an even more importantly, an even more enjoyable level of alcohol. Mm. True Romance is the Summer Ale to Unstoppable's White Claw.
I can't drink beer from Boston because I'll go into anaphylactic shock.
Right,
but
right.
I understand the metaphor. I understand the metaphor.
Yeah. I really, really loved this. I really loved just like how stylistically like audacious it is. I mean, like, it's kind of like a cliche at this point, but like there are people who refer to True Romance as like the best movie that Quentin Tarantino never directed. Mm. And there is some truth to that. Like, in some ways, it does feel more like a Quentin Tarantino movie than a Tony Scott movie, but it's also like more reserved than a Quentin Tarantino movie, like, than the movie would be if Quentin Tarantino directed it in rather than just writing it. And I think that's part of what I really loved about it was that, like, yeah, it has like a lot of like stylistic flourish to it, and there are moments of it just like going all out, and like the potential for like the violence of it all and just like the bombacity of it all, but it still like feels grounded in a lot of ways that I really enjoyed. It's just fun. Like, it's just high octane fun. I mean, the cast is obviously just insane.
Yeah.
But, like, also, I don't know, I love the... And, like, granted, like, you know, watching a movie starring Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette is different, like, now than maybe it would have been in, like, the early 90s when this was released. But I just also appreciated, like, that you had, like, these two actors that we still think about and talk about to some degree today, but, like, they're not, you know, as... you know, at the forefront of it as like Pulp Fiction is with watching like John Travolta and Uma Thurman, right? Like, it's just like a very different experience. So I just liked all of those like more subtle, like, strokes in the movie that, again, we just don't necessarily think of when we think of like Quentin Tarantino or to a certain extent, Tony Scott as well. So I had a lovely time with it.
There's a lot of smoke, which I know Quentin Tarantino does not like. He doesn't like about Tony Scott movies that there's so much smoke.
Mm.
I like the smoke in this movie. I like the cigarette smoke.
Yeah.
The smoke from the trains, the smoke from the sewers. There's a obscene amount of neon.
Yes.
And it's really kind of crazy. Like, as an action thriller director, especially in this movie, Tony Scott is really like, every frame is like lit to the max.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, the fucking every perfect shot, like that Twitter account is so fucking dumb. You know what I mean? Like but like you can really see in this movie, like every fucking piece of coverage is like thought out. It's like everything is there. And yeah, I just think that like the chemistry, especially like Patricia Arquette and Christian Slater, is like, it's just so undeniable. It's like,
yeah,
if they don't work, then the movie is just really dumb and it becomes, but it's like, they actually like really, like, you buy the chemistry.
Yeah.
It's really hard to sell stuff like that. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde stuff is like, has been done half to fucking death, and it's really hard to inject any kind of vitality like that, but it's so spectacular. This movie is just spectacular.
Well, and it's interesting because they're both such empty vessels too. Like both those characters are empty vessels, and like both those characters are underdeveloped. Like I think I was reading some stuff on it, and like people were commenting how like Patricia Arquette's character is like underdeveloped and an empty vessel. But I'm like, that's also Christian Slater's character. Like he does not get much dimension apart from like his love of movies and his desire to get like to get money, and in the same way that she isn't developed much more than like her sort of adhering to like these tropes of like the, you know, quote-unquote hooker with a heart of gold. So it's just like it feels very much like both of these are very shallow characters who stumble into like the titular true romance in a very short amount of time, and it also, even though they go through so much and come out the other end of it like still in love, and you know, spoiler alert, like their romance does feel like it's lasting, you still find yourself wondering if the romance is actually true, just like you find a lot of other aspects of the movie like questionable in terms of like how true it is because of how like polished and neon it all feels.
Probably a therapist could really sift their way through their relationship and find a lot of red flags quite quickly. But thankfully, a lot of therapists aren't writing film.
More so nowadays, it seems.
I guess both characters would have BPD. as would Gary Oldman.
Right. Gary Oldman, who is incredible in the movie. Like, such an underrated Gary Oldman performance.
Yeah, I mean, he has, well, for the audience who hasn't seen the movie, he has dreads, he has a glass eye,
scars on his face.
His accent is unrecognizable. Like, you can't even, you know, when, like, we talked about Emma Watson on The Bling Ring, you're like, oh, that's Emma Watson doing an impression of a girl from the Valley.
Right.
This voice is like, it's not a British guy doing an impression a white guy that likes rap, you know?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, you should have won for this instead of Darkest Hour.
Well, now you're speaking my language. Now you're speaking my language. And he didn't have to put a fat suit on.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true. I didn't mean anything by that. it's shockingly well made. Yeah, and it's real bullets, squibs, the final shoot. Matthew Modine is in this movie. He's so – the cops in this movie, I know ACAB, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
They're so funny in this movie. Give them a break. That's – anything else about True Romance? People should see it. It's such so
People
fun.
People should watch it. It's fun. Yeah. It's fun to throw on. Like some aspects of it haven't aged well. But it's a fun hang, and it's fun to have on in the background. You can stream it on Stars. I watched it on Stars, I believe. So if you have access to Stars, if you're part of the 1%,
and on the sixth day of his free trial, John will turn it off. one does. But
in
he's
the meantime,
a smart one. Yeah.
In the meantime, we love Stars. It's great. I don't have a ton more to say about it. I didn't take quite as detailed notes on this one as I did with The Long Goodbye. But you truly can't go wrong. It's a very underrated movie, like from the 90s, even though in a certain segment of like the, you know, film fandom sphere, it's talked about a lot. I feel like it's not one I hear a ton about necessarily. So very worth checking out.
Should we talk about our next episode now?
Yeah. Yes. Let's talk about our next episode. Not this coming week, but the week after, because we're going to take a week off. Two important things are happening. Pat, because the two of us are vaccinated, Pat is going to be visiting me in Syracuse, and we are going to be recording an in-person episode. And the second important thing that is happening is that this episode is our 50th episode. And it's also, interestingly enough, coming a week after the year anniversary of us launching this podcast. I believe, God. And I'm pretty sure that this episode is coming out on May 6th, which is the first, the 1 year anniversary of,
my God.
Yeah, which you truly can't make this shit up.
Holy shit.
So a lot of momentous stuff happening. Pat is turning the most unmomentous age in the human existence at 29. Our podcast has been released for a year. And then the week after that, or 2 weeks after that, we are releasing our 50th episode. So because of all of that, we thought it would be fun for us to do a little bit of a listener Q&A session. So if you would like to ask Pat and I a question, Pat and me, a question about...
I wasn't good. I didn't correct you because I don't know.
But some people would. If you have questions about film, music, entertainment, our lives, our personal lives.
Yeah, we will answer dating questions.
Yeah, yeah.
I will answer workout questions.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I will go to the bathroom during the answers to those questions.
John will get another one of his toxic Boston beers.
Yes.
We'll talk. We also play the Switch, too. Maybe we'll even have a little gaming minute.
Yeah,
Gaming minute.
We can answer questions about video games. We can answer questions about our friendship, like the entire catalog and encyclopedia of our friendship. Anything is totally fair game. So if you have questions, you can DM us on either our respective Instagrams or the podcast Instagram. We will also have a link to a Google form if you want to be more official about it. Any of that is totally fair game. If you want to have your name mentioned, please include that. If you don't, indicate that. We're totally willing to work with you if you want to send in.
And unfortunately, we will respect that.
We will respect that. Yeah, yeah. Pat's dad, a recovering lawyer, has informed us that we need to do that. And if you also want to send in recordings of your question, you can also do that. We love hearing from people. Yeah. We love hearing from former guests and listeners, all that kind of stuff.
And episode memories, too. If you just want to say, oh, I loved this episode, or if we're getting worse, just tell us.
Yeah, give us constructive feedback or not so constructive feedback, destructive feedback. All of that is totally fair game, too. So, we want to hear from as many people as possible. The more you send in, the longer we'll talk. So, bear that in mind. But that's what's on the horizon for episode 50, which is coming in 2 weeks from now. So, yeah. That's all I've got.
John, you got anything else to plug?
Nothing else to plug, no. Follow the Instagram. I just want to say, I think I've referenced this in passing on previous episodes, but since I started this past semester of grad school, I have been teaching. I have had a semi-intense course load and have just been dealing with various existential midlife crises or quarter-life crises. They feel like midlife crises. And Pat has taken the helm, has taken the steering wheel as it pertains to editing our episodes and running the Instagram. And I feel like there's no better time to recognize him than on his birthday or his birthday week. I've been editing podcasts for a couple years now and have edited a shit ton of podcasts and have learned the hard way that it is really difficult. And a lot of the stuff that you learn, you learn from, editing many episodes and doing it for years and years. And Pat has done the very difficult task of picking up editing a podcast that has many episodes behind it and has like done a really great job of taking feedback from me, which is not an easy thing to do, about ways to up his game as it pertains to editing, and has listened to me and watched tutorials on how to do various things with the editing software, and he's done a really kick-ass job. So I just want to recognize him and wish him a very, very happy birthday.
In the wake of all that. Thank you so much. This feels like Rich Gang the Tour Part 2.
That's what this podcast is.
It's the gift I never thought I would get. Well, I appreciate that so much from you, coming from you. and I appreciate your patience sometimes in helping me. There have been many times, the audience should know that there have been many times where I have purchased a firearm and I put John on FaceTime and I say, I'm going to shoot Audacity if right. you don't tell me what to do. And, you know, John cares about my security deposit. So he has.
I do. Because I'm getting it at the end of him living in his apartment.
He has navigated me through the torrid waters of Audacity. And no, I just want everybody to know that, you know, we're thinking big with this podcast. That feels so weird to say, but like, you know, in the coming weeks, you guys will see the commercial that we worked on very hard. And, you know, we're people are loving it and we're really proud to, I love editing this. I did not like it initially. I did not like carrying that torch, but, I have come to, it is actually one of my favorite things to do during the week. So,
Well, we will take you out with the last track or the other track that Pat brought in. This is what is this? This is Everything I Got from Rich Gang, The Tour, Part One, which you can find on various streaming platforms. So stay tuned for episode 50, send in your questions, and we will catch up with you guys later. Bye, y'all.
Thanks, guys. Everything I got, everything I got it on.